Red on Red.
I'm
when it's hidden away. When there's more to the thunder than there is to the rain. When your body's just moving and your dreams are displayed, I'll hold on to you as you push me away. I'll be a fool for you. I'll be a fool for you. I'll be a fool for you. I'll be a fool for you.
Alain Malone with My Baby's Dead and St. Keelan with I'll Be a Fool for You. This is Red on Red, Cork's new music podcast, dropping every Wednesday evening via Cork's Red FM and redextra.ie. We're also available on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. My name is Mike McGrath-Bryan, and this week we're joined in studio by Cormac and Bill of returning alt folk outfit Boa Morte. Lads, how's it going?
Good, Mike. Thanks for having us.
Very good. Thanks for having me.
First things first, brand new album, Before There Was Air, coming out September 27th, I believe, via Jard du Nord, across CD, digital. I hear there's like this massive multi-platform release happening.
Yeah, correct. And we're getting 180 gram vinyl pressed as well.
Ooh.
And actually, yeah, we've gone on pre-order with it. And it's amazing, like even already, yeah. It's 80% vinyl being sold. You know, maybe 10% CD, 10% digital download, but on pre-order so far. So that's an interesting breakdown.
We've done the sound comparison. It sounds much, I mean, it sounds great on vinyl. Yeah, it really does.
How do you find the response to yourselves announcing, not a comeback necessarily, because it never is, you know, like a hiatus or what have you. It's just a matter of other things kind of coming in the way. How have you found the response to the third album and the news rather?
Yeah, it's been encouraging so far. You know, it's probably we have a small but steady fan base from the previous two albums.
Yeah.
And they've gotten word of it at this stage. And there's a good degree of enthusiasm, which is heartwarming, I guess, because our output isn't exactly prolific, you know. So it's been, when was the last album? 2010?
2010,
by my reckoning.
Yeah, so 9 years. So after such a long gap, it's encouraging to see pretty warm welcome and a good degree of expectation, you know. So far, so good.
We'll talk about the new album in a bit more detail a little bit later on in the show. But first, you're celebrating your 20th anniversary this year. First of all, congratulations. Maybe take us back a little bit to how Boa Morte came together and that kind of snapshot of the scene as it was back in 1999, where maybe you're just before the real excesses of the Celtic Tiger, you know, and right before a lot of the venue shutdowns, etc. Talk to us a little bit about how that all came together.
I suppose we've known each other for a long time, going back to university days. And we're hanging out in the Liberty, which was the centre of the Cork music scene at the time. And so many bands came out of the Liberty. And I suppose we formed a couple of sort of noise bands or grunge type bands. Hubble was one of them.
The Lemmings before that.
The Lemmings before that.
Was that for the video game?
It wasn't. I don't know where the name came from. But whatever, we probably had very limited success. We got, you know, played on Fanning and all that kind of stuff in the Lemmings. And then Hubble produced, we did a couple of demos probably.
A couple of demos, yeah. One in Fermoy and Fiona Studios in Fermoy.
Yeah, supported the Franks and all that kind of stuff. Played Henry's and so, you know, we nice degree of local success.
Yeah.
Very much in the kind of Pavement, Sonic Youth.
Yeah.
Therapy, that kind of just noisy guitars, basically, right?
Your first EP released also in, I want to say, 2000, 2001?
Something like that.
Yeah, something like that. So I guess...
It was recorded in 2001, because there's a whole story when it comes to being signed by labels and things not necessarily working out. Maybe take us through the process of writing and recording it and what happened next.
Yeah. So maybe you could fill in the blanks, Cormac, but we had that whole Lemmings, Hubble, noise rock kind of era, let's say. But then in probably 98 into 99, you know, we decided that we wanted, for whatever reason, to change tack a little bit and change course, just to stimulate ourselves, I guess, a bit further. So that's when Boa Morte was formed. And yeah, we went to Dublin, I'm guessing in 98, probably, and we recorded the Passenger Measure Time EP with Mark Carolan. Who actually now is the sound engineer with Muse, as a random aside.
Another person to go on to greatness.
Yeah. So that EP was very much our calling card. I guess we got it out there to a lot of labels globally, and we had a good degree of interest. And it was Mood Food in the US, who were very much focused in that kind of alt folk general area that hooked onto it. Mood Food had Whiskey Town, of whom Ryan Adams was a member on the roster, and they hooked onto it, and they basically funded the recording of our first album proper.
They kind of ran aground fairly lively. Maybe talk to us a little bit about kind of like, had you any idea that things were about to happen, or?
Not really. I suppose there's geographical distance got in the way there, and we didn't really, we didn't hear from Mood Food for a while, and there was no sign of the record coming out. So we really didn't know that much about what was going on.
Yeah, and they'd invested a good bit of money in us. You know, we had a producer called Daniel Presley. He'd worked with the likes of the Breeders, who came over, spent weeks with us here.
Yeah.
We used to practice above a milking parlour up in Blarney, belonging to the dad of our drummer. And so we had this guy out of New York City, and he was a fairly cool guy, but actually we got to know him really well. So he ended up spending a lot of time in a dirty milking parlour loft, yeah, kind of fine-tuning the songs with us, working on orchestration and arrangements with us. And that was a huge learning, just having that dedicated time with somebody with his level of experience. And then he went hunting studios all around Ireland. We eventually settled on Sun Studios in Dublin because he was insistent that it had to be recorded in a two-inch tape deck with analog preamps and analog everything and straight to tape.
And those would have started going extinct at the time.
Yeah. So Cormac spent time in a car with him, visiting studios all over the country.
We drove around West Cork for a week looking at different studios because we had this ideal of recording in West Cork, but it really wasn't to be, was it? I mean, we needed the pro studio in Dublin.
Yeah. And a lot of the tape decks were just in really bad order. And he was extremely fussy, so we ended up going to Dublin for a number of weeks recording the album. So, you know, they easily spent a good five-figure sum between paying him, paying for the studio time, paying, you know, mixing, mastering, all that kind of stuff. So they invested a lot in it. And then
Mark Carolan came in and finished the album, actually, when we'd broken free of it.
He came in
and mixed it.
Basically moved through Satnet for a long time. It became apparent then that they weren't going to release it because they went bankrupt. But they actually refused to release the tapes back to us.
Did they think that there was going to be some sort of like collateral or other value to it in the long run without it being released in the first place?
Yeah, they wanted us to buy the tape back. Yeah, they absolutely wanted us to buy it back. And we ended up getting a music intellectual property rights lawyer on board to go head to head with their intellectual property rights lawyer. And eventually they gave in. And it was more about just, you know, sticking it out, and they just got fed up of the waiting, basically, in the end. And we ended up getting the rights for the album back in our own hands at that stage. And then we were back at the start, flogging it out to record companies around the place to see if there'd be any takers. But at least we had a fully finished album at this stage, right? Yeah.
There's about 4 years between the band coming together and the release of the first record. Obviously, you know, the release of an EP will keep people going, etc., as well as regular gigging activity. How did you manage to kind of keep everything afloat with this legal battle ongoing, managing and just generally keeping the momentum up?
Well, as you may have spotted, we don't move that quickly, really, and We actually did quite a few gigs in those times between 1998 and 2002, and the lobby was really was very busy, and we did quite a few gigs and in the lobby actually in that time. If you look at the lobby book, you can see the listings. So I suppose we had something to aim for in releasing it through Shoeshine eventually. So it seemed to happen quicker than it actually did.
Yeah, looking back in the notes, now that you mentioned 4 years, Mike, it doesn't seem like that to us.
I mean, the story of it, of Shoeshine picking up on it.
We'll talk about that a little bit later on, but I suppose maybe talk to us a little bit about, you know, Wrangles aside, because that's what people will remember and that's what people kind of still talk about. Mm. It still gets mentioned in press releases or what have you. Just talk to us, I suppose, about the writing of the songs in the first place, because it's one thing to, you know, deal with like a US producer coming through and seeing the milking parlour and whatever else, but when it came down to it, etc., talk to us a little bit, I suppose, about transitioning from that first EP to fleshing out everything to your first album. Just what were your thoughts, your feelings, your ideas going into an LP?
Well, I mean, the reason we did the EP with Mark Carolan was because he'd worked with Jubilee All-Stars, so it was a band that we really liked from Dublin. We liked their sound, and there was quite a big alt country scene in Ireland at the time, and in Dublin in particular. So we decided to work with Mark Carolan. That sort of formulated a sort of a sound and an aesthetic. And I suppose we were listening to a lot of Bonnie Prince Billy and people like that, Silver Jews, so we were starting to write these sort of slower songs. That fitted this sort of very slow alt country sort of scene that we were sort of fitting into. And the typical writing process is that either myself or Paul, as another writer, would write songs at home, bring them into the band room. We'd put them through the Bo Morte machine and come up with arrangements and stuff like that. So, I mean, I suppose we're other bands we were influenced by at the time were Lamb Chop, who were just really doing some great stuff. I'm trying to think back. But we were really influenced by that sort of aesthetic, really slow-moving folk, alt-folk music. And I suppose that the three songs we recorded for the EP ended up on the album, and new versions of them ended up on the album. So we just we filled out the rest of the album quite quickly, actually.
Yeah,
from
exactly.
1998.
I think it grew kind of organically. It's not as if we went in with a preformed idea that we want every song to be slow.
Yeah.
And we want to create a certain mood. But you know, as we layered on the various elements of the songs, it kind of a sound developed over time.
Mm.
We ended up, you know, bringing on board some additional musicians then in terms of strings, and there's a cello player who played on that album, Louise O'Flynn, who still plays with us actually. We use violins, we use brass. We've got this multi-instrumentalist called Dermot McDermott, who's played in a number of, you know, pretty successful Dublin bands like the Jimmy Cake and so forth.
Mm.
And he ended up doing a lot of stuff that got included, clarinet and so forth, on the first album. So it's really true. Spending time on the songs ourselves, working, thinking carefully about the arrangements, you know, pulling in other musicians. And I think if anything, that time between releasing the EP and ultimately when the first album got released allowed us probably time we wouldn't have had otherwise to mature the sound and develop it a bit more organically than we might have otherwise.
When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about the pickup of the album by a label, and I suppose really the effect of that mass exposure that it received on the band and how you kind of perceive things going forward. But first, we're going to go to some more tunes. But coming up on September 21st in Dali, the Old Pav on Carey's Lane, Dublin instrumental duo Bicurious are performing in their first headline show in the city, I believe. Coming up, we have two bands from that billing on September 21st in Dali. We have 10 Past 7, who are making a rare live appearance. Of course, Kerry's famed Bog Prog Power Trio. But first, we have Northside Youngfella's God Alone with Feeling I'll Tick, a tune that we premiered last week on the Red on Red podcast, recorded live at the Paranoid Pit at Fred Zeppelin's, here on Red on Red.
This song's called Feeling I'll Tick. We'll be right back.
cracks of reality. Pink sky savage, strikes me, puts me to the pillow and barrels. Got the darkness, it's pain in my stomach. It's like a black wall, like I'm on the sun. And I'm the fool that it on.
10 past 7 with Johnston's Cows, part of the lineup on September 21st in Daly on Carey's Lane in Cork City. Acting support for Bicurious, Dublin instrumental duo. Tickets €10, kickoff at 6:30 at Daly. This is Red on Red, Cork's new music podcast, and we're still joined in studio by Cormac and Bill from Boa Morte. And before the jump, we were talking a little bit about how the band came together, your initial excursions, and your wrangles with your first label. Before we went to Tunes, we kind of left it at being picked up by Shoeshine Records, the label run by the drummer from Teenage Fan Club. Talk to us a little bit, I suppose, about once the album was done and was kind of played about locally a bit, talk to us a little bit about the shopping process to labels, because that's something that's maybe a bit lost now with all the changes in the industry, bands going it alone, etc. Just for listeners that might not be so familiar with the process of label shopping, as it were, talk to us about how things came together and what it took to get the deal done.
Well, I mean, back in those days, obviously, there were no links or online links, so everything was physical copy. So we did a load of CDRs of the album and sent them, just basically sent them with press releases off to different different labels. And so we got some interest, and a few people got back to us. But the story goes that Francis McDonald was recording with Teenage Fan Club at the time. He got the CD and played it during a recording session on the desk. So I suppose it was going through some fairly heavy hi-fi equipment. It probably sounded pretty good. So supposedly, the Teenage Fan Club, the rest of the band liked it as well, and persuaded him to check us out, and eventually signed us to the label. You know, it was great to get that recognition, because he had some sort of up and coming acts on the label, and very good distribution of the label as well across the UK, and some worldwide distribution as well. So it was great to get on a label that actually had distribution across UK and Ireland. It got us into record shops and into magazines and stuff.
Having been kind of fit up with a good distribution network, and I suppose what kind of stands out to me when I kind of look at, or when anybody kind of searches up the first record, is just the trail of press that it receives. Yeah. Everything from the Enemy putting on rave reviews to Hot Press featuring it on, you know, an all-timers list.
Yeah.
Talk to us, I suppose, about that whirlwind of press attention that the album got. Kind of, how did you feel about all of this praise just being volleyed at you right at this time, after you'd been through so much, and just kind of how you felt about the whole process, how it maybe kind of changed your perspective on the process of releasing something and putting, you know, giving something to the public?
Yeah, it's a good question. Not something necessarily spent too much time thinking about, but I think at the time it just all seemed to happen very easily, almost, you know. And it certainly, speaking personally, it kind of took me a little bit by surprise. It was great kind of validation, I guess, to get signed up so quickly, second time round. We really didn't have a clue what to expect when the reviews started coming in, and when the reviews started coming in and they were universally positive, I must admit, I was surprised. We probably underestimated maybe to some extent the quality of the songs, the quality of the recording as well. I think that really helped. It really stood up that Daniel Presley, you know, insisted on, you know, all of that vintage gear, and he got a really smooth analog sound to the whole album, which helped, right? But yeah, as the reviews came in, I must admit it kind of took me by surprise, but came very naturally as well at the same time, because I guess we did have a lot of confidence that there was something in the songs, and there was something in the in terms of the quality of the album as an entity that we were very, very happy with. So it was good to get that reaffirmed.
But this was also at a time where maybe the music press in the UK and Ireland, you know, still very heavily print-based, online only starts to come through by about 2002. And there's still somewhat of the rock and roll myth-making to being in a magazine, that, you know, you're kind of, your perception changes almost when you're, or the perception of your band changes when you're on The Enemy, as opposed to maybe today where music press is a bit more fragmented. Kind of, what are your thoughts now on the music press?
Yeah, I guess the big difference is the whole online internet element, and the skew towards, you know, blogs, online YouTube channels, podcasts such as this one. It has been a paradigm shift, because back then getting a review in Uncut, Mojo, NME, Hot Press, whatever, that was it. You know, you got a great review there. That's what everybody read to get their, to inform themselves on what's coming true from a musical perspective. And you were able to build a following pretty quickly. You know, we did a UK tour with some of our bandmates as part of the album launch, and you know, we were stunned to find that there was, you know, a couple of hundred people turning out to see us in places like Hull and Glasgow, and you know, where did these people come from? But they came from a cohort of people that relied on the magazines for their musical direction. Nowadays, it seems to me that it's far more dispersed. The number of nodes where people go to get their musical information is absolutely far more dispersed than it was in the past. So actually, in some ways, I think it's become harder to find an audience because people are relying on so many different types of outlets. I think probably the volume of music coming through towards those outlets is far greater as well. So I think it's, if anything, and Cormac, I'm not sure what you think about this. It's not something we've necessarily talked about, but I think it's probably harder to find that audience now, which is kind of ironic, given that in some ways it's a lot easier because it's easier to put stuff online, it's easier to get stuff to blogs. But because of that dispersal effect, I think it's possibly become harder to reach people.
What do you reckon then of the idea of the restoration of some sort of like accepted seal of approval, like Peel would have been, or like Fanning would have been, or like certain music journalists would have been? Like, do you think they reside on YouTube or in podcasts, etc.?
I suppose Pitchfork at one point was the go-to review source for a lot of people, and I suppose it's going to change, isn't it? It changes on a regular basis. There's some YouTube channels that are quite informative. I mean, personally, I still rely on the magazines as sort of catalogues of the new releases, and I still look at Uncut and flick through and see type of thing I like. Now, I won't like a lot of it, but I can sort of read the reviews and decide what I might check out. And I suppose Spotify is very useful because it allows you to check out a load of stuff. And then I do force myself to buy the things that I enjoy to support the artists, you know.
Absolutely.
But certainly the financial model has changed hugely.
So off the back of all the success then, to where you end up touring the major towns in the UK off the back of this critical acclaim, it takes 8 years to get to album number 2, The Dial Waltz. Maybe talk to us a little bit about kind of what changes were happening in the music industry kind of after the first album cycle. CD begins tailing off, downloading starts happening, and all of a sudden shopping to labels becomes a little bit different.
I mean, well, obviously what we should have done is really moved with a lot of momentum behind us from the first album. We should have really, I suppose, moved quickly, and, you know, I mean, but I suppose life gets in the way sometimes, and we weren't really in a position to go full time into the music and tour the album more extensively. So I suppose, you know, in some ways we missed a crucial window of opportunity, but in other ways, as Bill said earlier, that, you know, you have a lot more time to work on the songs. Now, of course, we took it to the extreme, but it certainly gave us a lot of time to work on the songs and work through new arrangements for the second album. And we actually ended up recording the second album around maybe 2006 or 7.
Yeah.
So it was actually recorded within a couple of years. It took 4 years to record it, to get around to recording it. So I suppose we let things drift a bit, but I mean, we're all, you know, in jobs, in professional jobs, and you know, it's not like we were full-time musicians. So time just drifted a bit, and we were able to really polish the songs though a lot for the second album. But I suppose we did let the grass grow under our feet a bit.
Yeah, a bit. And to your point then, Mike, I guess the scene in the music industry probably changed a lot in that period. It's when online really came to the fore. You know, a lot of the independent record labels that were probably consolidated a lot. A lot of them folded. You know, we've talked about Move Food, Shoeshine, who we were signed to. They started really slowing their output.
They contracted a lot.
A lot, because people were, at the time, MySpace was kind of taking off, and that in itself around 2004, 5, 6 kind of really changed. That's what really brought a lot more music online. brought the kind of whole DIY element, the bedroom bands, gave them an audience, and suddenly the amount of music that people had to listen to, either on CD or online, just exploded, really, you know, in that period of time. So I guess we were kind of, as Cormac said, we were working our way through that, building up some new songs at our own pace. But when it came to the recording or the release then of the second album and shopping them around, we probably found that a lot of the people we would have shopped around to were really nervous about the model and signing bands and signing records. Whereas back in, you know, we got signed twice for the first album.
Yeah.
We couldn't get signed for the second album, even though we would say that the music, the quality of the recordings was equally as good, right?
Yeah,
because I think record labels were extremely nervous about the old contracting a band
type
model,
right? They could see the change in the financial landscape. And when we released the first album, you could sell enough copies for the record label to make their money back quite easily and then make a profit. Whereas by the time we got around to releasing the second album, you're really looking at a different model, which involves a lot of touring, a lot of live shows, real, you know, bands that are full time plugging away, you know, on tour for 300 days a year.
Yeah.
And so we really weren't that type of band, so it didn't quite suit us anymore.
Yeah.
You then took the decision to self-release the Dial Waltz amid all of this tumult and all of this happening in the music business at the time. Maybe talk to us a little bit about your experiences with being your own bosses, so to speak. Hmm. How did you find that experience?
Yeah, it was actually okay looking back on it. I guess we are lucky in that we all had full-time jobs. We probably weren't in a position where we necessarily had to recoup at all, but we certainly were interested in recouping as much as possible.
Hmm.
And really, our primary motivation was just to get the music out there in front of people and to make sure that, you know, we still had it to some degree, right? And we probably wanted that validation. We were very happy with the album ourselves. So to try to maximize the exposure, you know, we did sign up Cargo as a distributor. We did that ourselves for UK and Ireland just to get physical copies out there. I think back then, in terms of getting it out digitally, however, the infrastructure really wasn't as mature as it is now to allow a band like us to get stuff out there and get it widely made available digitally. We went through a digital distribution company in the US called CD Baby, and they were quite good. They also did some physical distribution, but the Bandcamp was really immature at that stage, and now that is a model which can generate, you know, okay revenues for bands to sell digital and physical copies of their albums. That didn't really exist in a very meaningful way back in 2010 when we were trying to get it going. So we were kind of caught in a kind of a pivot point, I guess, between the physical model and the digital model, which resulted in probably the album not getting the degree of exposure and sales that we would have liked. So even though Cargo distributed physically across, you know, all the major record shops in UK and Ireland, people weren't really buying physical. Even they're probably buying less than they are even now, you know, back then, because it was cool to get the digital download, to download your MP3, you know, even though Spotify wasn't there, there was a lot of piracy going on and whatever.
And it almost seems quaint to talk about MP3 now, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. It's amazing. So it was at a funny pivot point in terms of the whole industry. And I think we were kind of victims, not wanting to sound like victims, but I think as a result of that, it probably didn't get the kind of exposure that we would have liked to seen it get. You know, we got it reviewed in Uncut and Mojo and so forth. It got really good reviews. But after those reviews, not a whole lot else happened in terms of sales and so forth, right?
Talk to us a little bit then about the creative process behind it, because as you mentioned, a big part of it was validation. A big part of it was proving to yourselves that, quote unquote, you still had it. Over the course of the time it took to rehearse, record and release the whole thing, maybe talk to us a little bit about how the process differed between the first album and the second album, kind of what you had brought forward, what your inspirations were.
Funnily enough, not a whole lot changed in terms of the creative process. And I suppose through a lack of imagination, we brought back Daniel Presley. I mean, we got on so well with him as a producer that he was living in Paris at the time, so he came in to produce the second album, and we were just really comfortable working with him. And we knew that the quality of the recording would be spot on. So we worked with Daniel again in the same studio and went through the same process, you know. And I mean, in terms of writing the songs, we took the same sort of route. I think we focused more on orchestrations for the second album a bit more. You know, in some ways it was really quite a similar process, you know.
Yeah. Orchestration in terms of, you know, being in a room and three or four people together, etc., and, you know, putting together the bones of a song. Mm. Maybe for those that aren't familiar with the process, maybe talk to us a little bit about orchestration and where big sweeping string sections and other complementary presences start to enter into the creative process. How is that idea articulated in its very first iterative stages?
Well, I mean, the thing I like about us is that we have a sort of a sound. We have a way of playing the bass. The drummer is very distinctive. So we have a sort of a sound that is the four of us playing in a room. And what we tend to do is work with that as the fundamental basis of what we do, and then keep adding layers to it and adding orchestration and leaving gaps, if you like, for the orchestration to little pieces of the soundscape where they can go. But really, we come up with it together, actually. So the basic song is written by one of us, and then we come in and arrange the song as a band, and one of us will say, hang on, I've got this great sound for the last album. It was a synth sound. It'll go here and it'll fill out the sound in this area. And then somebody would have an idea for a sort of an ascending string line, and sort of you'd hear it in your head, and it sort of all fitted into place. More recently, we've been, and we do tend to multi-track to do some demos in the band room, so that we actually piece it out before we go into the studio. So we do work quite a bit on the orchestrations, of course.
I think so, yeah. And you know, we probably meddle a lot with song structure. You know, we don't go for the verse chorus middle eight chorus end kind of thing very much. And just by having that kind of looser kind of structure, probably lends itself to growing bits and pieces and letting songs meander and find their own course. I think we were conscious after the Dial Waltz that while we were very happy with the album, that, you know, it was very two guitars, bass, drums with some embellishments. And we wanted to try something different for the third album, maybe more complex arrangements, a broader palette in terms of the instruments that we used. So I think that was the big difference in terms of orchestration, I think, between album two and album three. So over the past, I guess, 5 years, we've spent a lot more time working on different elements, different soundscapes to maybe what we had in the first two albums.
We'll talk a little further about the creative process behind album number three, Before There Was Air, which is available on September 27th via Jardin du Nord, across digital and physical. We've got a pair of Cork hip-hop artists that have released recently. First, we have Jar Jar Jr. with Earthed, the magnificent jazzy finisher to his most recent EP, Free Parking on Sundays. And we have Gaptoof with Overdue, an instrumental single of his that was recently reissued across digital platforms after doing some time on SoundCloud and the like. This is Jar Jar Jr. with Earthed here on Red on Red. Thank you. Gaptooth with Overdue here on Red on Red, still in studio with Cormac and Bill from returning Leaside alt folk troubadours Boa Morte. Of course, album number 3 on the way out September 27th. Before the break, we were just talking a little bit about the orchestration process for records, and that segued nicely into the creation of album number 3, which is really not heavier but allows for more of space for that kind of thing to breathe in your songs. I suppose by album number 3 you're already kind of set in your ways, you know what you're about, etc. Maybe talk to us a little bit about the concept behind Before There Was Air, how it came together, what the process was like this time around, and again, even if it didn't change so much, you kind of moved into a much different studio environment, even if there were some familiar faces involved.
I guess, again, the process probably, as we alluded to earlier, probably didn't change too dramatically, but we were conscious that we just wanted to expand our soundscape somewhat, you know. So, you know, in terms of Cormac and Paul bringing songs to the group and us developing them, that really didn't change dramatically. But we did probably consciously decide to stretch ourselves a little bit in terms of just working more on the orchestration and arrangements, bringing more elements into them, bringing more sounds into them. So on that resulted, I guess. And that was probably over the course of a few years again, yeah, you know. It's, yeah. We tend to move slowly at this stuff. But it resulted in us probably using, you know, more drones, more guitar effects, more synths. Just, I guess, more elements, I guess, than we had considered in the past. And then, you know, it's one thing doing that in the studio and doing it on 4-track or 8-track or whatever, or doing it in the practice room on 4-track and 8-track. But we did more of that probably this time than we had in the past.
Yeah.
So I think when we went into the studio eventually, we were probably more comfortable with what we wanted the end result to sound like than maybe we had been in the past.
I think so. I mean, in the previous albums, we really stuck to an acoustic aesthetic, if you like. So we had harmonium. Rather than having a synthesizer, we'd play a harmonium or we'd play a piano. Whereas this time we said, right, all bets are off. We can use the digital technology of the studio, which we hadn't really had at our disposal in the past. We can bring in a synth, and we started practicing with a synth, and it was a Juno 106. So making drones as we're playing and arranging the songs influenced the sort of soundscape a lot more, and then we used the studio to our advantage as well by being able to cut up pieces and doing things that we couldn't have done on tape, which was a long time ago. But so we changed the process subtly. Yeah, and I think that's reflected in the sound.
I think through that time as well, our listening patterns ourselves had probably developed a good bit as well. You know, Cormac, you'd always been into Brian Eno and the ambient stuff, you know, but more of us got into the likes of John Hopkins. We were influenced by some other stuff, like, you know, the John D and Alex Rice Boy Sleeps album. Mm. You know, so more thoughtful, premeditated approach to orchestration and arrangement became part of what we did. We weren't afraid to let songs ramble on for 7 or 8 minutes necessarily.
Are you going to see John Hopkins at Dali as part of Sounds from a Safe Harbour happening next month?
Yeah, absolutely. If he wasn't sold out, you know, so.
You know, there's always ways and means. There's always going to be somebody with a ticket going last minute, etc.
Exactly.
So
yeah, we're gonna keep an eye
on your Facebook event pages, you know.
I think we'll get to Sam Amadon as well, Efter Klang as well.
Yeah. So going to try and get to you as much as possible, I guess.
Good.
There's a fair amount happening over the course of those couple of days at venues around Cork City. But now that the third album is all finished up with, as you mentioned, like an expanded sonic palette, you know, exploring both old and newer influences in a whole bunch more detail. Always a weird one to ask bands, because you can never listen to your own material the same way you listen to somebody else's, because you're so familiar with every single aspect of it. But how do you feel about Before There Was Air as a finished piece, now that you've heard masters or have been sitting on them for a while or what have you? Talk to us a little bit about kind of just that experience of listening to something that you created as a thing that is now in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're very happy with it, obviously. And we, you know, it's difficult to be critical of your own work, especially when you've heard it quite a few times through the mixing, mastering process and so on, you know. But hearing it all together, I think we're really pleased with how it's turned out. I mean, as an actual album that fits together, and maybe an album is an old-fashioned concept as well, but to listen to it from start to finish, I think it works really, really well because of, I suppose, what we've just been talking about. All the songs are designed to be orchestrated into each other, and actually it doesn't fall to digital silence through the album, so everything overlaps, and we're very conscious of the sequencing of the album from that point of view. So I suppose, I'd say it's about 65% singing, 35% instrumentation. So, whereas the other albums would have been a lot more sung. So I think it just, to me, it works really well. The flow between the songs, you know, works as well as we had envisaged. And maybe something like, you know, we often talk about Brian Eno's Another Green World, albums like that which have singing and instrumentation on them. They just flow along. And that would be sort of something that we were looking for in this record. Yeah. I think we've achieved it, I hope.
I think so, yeah. I think you're right, Cormac. I think there was a lot more thought put into it as a sonic entity, maybe, than the last album. You know, thematically, we've tried to make it into, create linkage between the songs. But sonically, in terms of the soundscape, you know, we recorded it completely differently to the first two albums, where it was almost like an audiophile approach to recording in pristine quality onto 2-inch tape. This time we decided, you know, we wanted to record the bass, the foundation of the album, live as a band in a room in Herbert Place Studio, with mics open, so that we can pick up just that feel of a band playing a song together. Yeah. And then taking those elements that Cormac spoke about, you know, synths, drones, digital effects and so forth, and layering those on top of that very, very organic, basic sound of the band playing together. So I guess, we put a lot more thought and deliberation because I guess we didn't have a very experienced professional producer who called the shots on the album. It's very much self-produced, but yeah. We did have a very clear idea of the kind of aesthetic that we were looking for. And I think when I listen back to it, I think that's very evident. You know, there is that uniformity in terms of the sonic character of the album. But then it's sprinkled with lots of diverse elements as you go through it to try to hold the attention.
It's important to say, you know, to give credit to James Darkin as well, who's the engineer and helped produce a lot of the tracks. And really, with James, you know, working with James rather than working with Daniel was a big difference in the style that they brought to the album, and he really allowed us to to do all that. He set the place up to suit us, and he really was a whiz at the digital editing side and things like that. So we really brought a lot to the album, I think.
Yeah, and
more modern.
He's a musician himself. Yeah, he's released a couple of kind of industrial electronic albums. So he brought an aesthetic, an ability with digital mixing and effects that probably would have been alien to us, to be honest. So that helped to give it a colour that it may not otherwise have had.
And after all of the tumult that you've had with labels over the years, things happening and industry models shifting, it's third time's the charm. This time around for another label, this time with Jar du Nord. Maybe talk to us a little bit about how you got in touch this time around, what the deal is. I know earlier we were talking about 180 gram vinyl release and the success of the vinyl revival kind of impacting on how pre-orders have been taken up for this record. How did they come together and what have they been like to work with thus far?
Again, you know, this involved us approaching a number of labels, and again we got some good interest. And it was Ian Button who runs the label, Jar du Nord. The label was set up really to release music by friends of his in London, and he has distribution through the UK. And, you know, he really liked what we were doing and offered to put it out. He's been mixed up in bands like State River Widening, which is a post-rock band of the about 15 years ago. Kieran Phelan is another person he puts out. So they've got a very good following of the type of music that he puts out. So we're delighted when he wanted to put out the album, because it gives us a reach into the UK a bit more than we would have had.
I think we were prepared to probably go our own and do a self-release if necessary. But it was great to get that extra oomph that you get from a label. I think probably it is easier to do a self-release now than it probably was maybe 10 years ago with the second album. As Cormac said, having that increased level of exposure through a UK record label, just in terms of the contacts that they've got with the various media outlets and blogs and podcasts and so forth in the UK is very welcome. They haven't had exposure into Ireland really as such, I think.
Not really.
We're helping them to push that
thing, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think we'll help to give them some exposure as well, probably here, which they're welcoming. I think it's a nice symbiotic relationship, and it certainly is working well for us so far.
Does that mean there's going to be another incursion into the UK soon?
Yeah, well, certainly in terms of release, absolutely. In terms of playing, then probably. We don't have anything penciled in as yet. We're just focusing on Ireland, really. At the moment, but we've already had we've a bit of a fan base in the UK and online and our social media and so forth. They've heard about the album, they're looking forward to it, so I think at some stage it would be good to get back over, maybe just play a London show.
When we come back, we'll talk about your upcoming slate of gigs, including a number of gigs around Cork. But first, we're going to go back to some more tunes, a double dose of Cork psychedelia. First off, we have the Altered Hours with Over the Void, taken from their On My Tongue EP. We also have Ghost King Is Dead with Deflector, bedroom pop that has really done well online as a result of its release via Cork bedroom pop collective Hausu, but also having been released on tape recently as part of his This Is Doubt EP, which received a limited release on the format during the course of the Hausu night that was at Cypress Avenue just a couple of weeks ago. But first, this is the Altered Hours with Over the Void here on Red on Red.
sit down.
Ghost King is Dead with Deflector, available now across all streaming services via Cork Bedroom Pop Collective House Who Records. This is Red on Red, Cork's new music podcast. We're still joined in studio by Cork alt folk outfit Boa Morte. Cormac, Bill, the album is all confirmed. It's good to go on September 27th, and you have a rake of gigs coming up to help mark the occasion.
Yeah, we've got a number of gigs, I guess, to be announced, but we've got some that are confirmed over the next month or so. Starting off in the Glucksman Gallery in Cork, which we're really looking forward to on September 20th. So we'll be, you know, we're going to have a full band there with strings, with synths, with the whole lot. So it's going to be a big sound in a big square box, which will be interesting, but we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to the sound of that one. So that's at 8 p.m. on Culture Night on September 20th. We're back after the release then, playing in the Roundy on October the 19th, actually, in the Roundy inside in town. So working with Jimmy and the guys in there to get that gig together. And then we're playing in Dublin in Barbello, which was previously the Lower Deck in Portobello, a really nice venue, on October the 24th. So they're confirmed. We've got some other gigs, as I said, to be confirmed over the next week or so. So people can catch up on those, I guess, at boamorte.com. We've also got our Twitter site. People will find us there. Slightly less active Facebook site, but we're on all the major media channels, I guess.
You also have your new single, Deep Is Deeper, which is now streaming on the front end of boamorte.com, linking out to the Bandcamp pre-order, where physicals as well as digitals can be pre-ordered of the new record before there was air, available via Gare du Nord Records. How are you feeling about how pre-orders have been taken up?
Yeah, really good so far. You know, it's our first time doing a pre-order type of setup on Bandcamp. It's going really, really well. It's probably far exceeding any expectations that we would have had. As I said earlier, what's kind of amazing us as well is just the proportion of vinyl, which is 80%, to CD, which is about 10%, to digital, which is 10%. That'll probably shift a bit maybe after release itself. But right now, the early pre-ordering people are ordering primarily vinyl, which is interesting.
Yeah, and I suppose you do get a download code with the vinyl as well. Just
of course.
Plug for that.
Yeah.
Are you over the line, do you think, with vinyl yet?
Yeah. It's getting towards that, probably quicker than we would have anticipated. So wouldn't say we're quite there yet, but we're well on the road and certainly ahead of where we would have thought we would be, yeah.
That's all for this week's episode of Red on Red, Cork's new music podcast from Red FM and redextra.ie. Thank you very much to Cormac and Bill of Boa Morte for joining us in studio this episode.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
And thank you very much for listening. If you like what you're hearing, please take the time to subscribe and leave us a review on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Every subscribe, every rate, every social media share helps us spread the word of DIY music in Cork City. Make sure to check out the artists featured online or at an upcoming gig. And if you'd like more Irish tunes, please be sure to listen into Green on Red on Sunday nights with Alan O'Donovan for the best of all that is Irish on Cork's Red FM, 104 to 106. We mentioned the new single, Deep Is Deeper, which is available now for immediate download if you make a digital pre-order via bandcamp.com, via frampoamorteaband.com. But we're going to give people just a listen to it here. Maybe talk to us a little bit about the writing in particular of this tune and how it came together.
This is very much a band song, so the foundation of the song is really the four of us playing in the room. It's mostly live, the track, and then it sort of fades out to an interesting ending that I'll leave you listen to as we play out the track.
We're going to hear from it right now. This is Boa Morte with Deep Is Deeper. This has been Red on Red, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sleep on the road, on the road, on the road. The tide is low.
Red on Red.